Good evening once again. I'm Chris Janssen in for Brian Williams. Day 248 of the Biden administration. And the stage appears to be set for what could be a legal showdown between the current White House and former President Trump. Today, the White House indicated that it is willing to cooperate with the House committee investigating the Capitol riot on January 6th. That committee is expected to request Donald Trump's records from that day, which could help lawmakers find out exactly what Trump and his aides were doing as the violence erupted.
We will respond promptly to these questions as they arise, and certainly as they come up from Congress. And certainly we have been working closely with congressional committees and others as they work to get to the bottom of what happened on January 6th, an incredibly dark day in our democracy.
Tonight, Politico reports, quote, the White House said it intends to review each request by the former president to prevent the disclosure of such records on a case-by-case basis. Just yesterday, the January 6th committee subpoenaed four top Trump insiders, including former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former strategist Steve Bannon. This is all unfolding as the final report on the so-called audit of the 2020 vote in Arizona's Maricopa County confirms that not only did Biden win, but he won by an even wider margin than originally believed. The House Oversight Committee is now asking for testimony next month from the CEO of the Cyber Ninjas. That's the group that carried out the five-month review. Meanwhile, the president is trying to save his domestic agenda from falling apart. He's working to keep congressional Democrats together ahead of a key vote next week on a trillion-dollar infrastructure bill and advance his $3.5 trillion plan to expand the social safety net. This follows a chaotic exit from Afghanistan, the Delta COVID surge, and the situation at the border. This morning, Biden was asked about his campaign promise to bring competence to the White House.
So what do you say to Americans who say that you have not delivered on that promise?
Remember, I said it's going to take me a year to deliver everything I'm looking at here. That's number one. Number two, take a look at what I inherited when I came into office. Every element of my economic plan is overwhelmingly popular. Overwhelmingly popular. But the problem is, with everything happening, not everybody knows what's in that plan. And the plans we're now debating in the United States, among ourselves, and they're debating in Congress, is the plan, the essence of the plan that I laid out in the beginning. And so I'm confident that at the end of the day, we're going to be able to get that done. I make no apologies for my proposals, how I'm proceeding. It's going to go up and it's going to go down. It's going to go up. And hopefully at the end of the day, I'll be able to deliver on what I said I would do.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she intends to move forward with votes on Biden's agenda, even with those divisions between moderate and progressive Democrats.
Madam Speaker, how are you feeling about the Monday vote? You think you're still on schedule?
I think we're on a good path.
Tonight, the White House says the president had a call with both Speaker Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer this afternoon and will be in touch with them over the weekend. All of this happening amid concerns of a possible government shutdown and raising the debt ceiling. A moment ago, we mentioned the situation at the U.S. southern border. Over the past several days, thousands of migrants, many of whom were from Haiti, were camped under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. Today, the Homeland Security Secretary announced that camp has been cleared. He also addressed the controversy over images of border agents on horseback chasing migrants.
As of this morning, there are no longer any migrants in the camp underneath the Del Rio International Bridge. We, our entire nation, saw horrifying images that do not reflect who we are, who we aspire to be, or the integrity and values of our truly heroic personnel in the Department of Homeland Security. The agents involved in these incidents have been assigned to administrative duties and are not interacting with migrants while the investigation is ongoing.
And in addition to all of that, the administration has started rolling out boosters for those who have gotten Pfizer shots. A CDC advisory panel had recommended those 65 and over, and some people at high risk get those additional shots. The CDC director endorsed that part of their recommendation, but overruled the panel and said guidelines would also include high-risk workers. And today, the president welcomed the decision.
We took a key step in protecting the vaccinated with booster shots. The majority of Americans who were fully vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine are now able to receive the booster shot 6 months after they've received their second shot. It's hard to acknowledge I'm over 65, but I'll be getting my booster shot. We've made incredible progress in vaccinating Americans. We still have over 70 million Americans who have failed to get a single shot. And to make matters worse, there are elected officials actively working to undermine with false information the fight against COVID-19. This is totally unacceptable. The vast majority of Americans are doing the right thing. Three quarters of the eligible have gotten at least one shot.
And we're going to have much more on those booster guidelines just ahead. We also saw on live television today what so many of us are dealing with when it comes to the ongoing challenges of navigating in-person activity amid a pandemic. It all unfolded on The View right before a scheduled on-set interview with Vice President Kamala Harris.
Can someone please apprise me of the situation?
I need the two of you to step off for a second.
Okay. Anna and
we're going to bring Sonny you back later.
Have to
okay.
leave.
Yes.
And we'll tell you why.
More information later. It's a tease.
We'll tell you why in a couple of minutes. So shall I introduce the vice president?
Yes.
Okay. So, Vice President, what happened is that Sonny and Anna both apparently tested positive for COVID. No matter how hard we try, these things happen. They probably have a breakthrough case, and they'll be okay, I'm sure, because they're both vaccinated.
So what we're going to try to do now is do an interview with the vice president remotely.
So Joy Behar did go on to interview Kamala Harris remotely. The White House says the vice president did not come into contact with the show's hosts. With that, let's bring in our leadoff guests on this Friday night. Jonathan Lemire, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Susan Page, veteran journalist, best-selling author, and longtime Washington bureau chief for USA Today. And Cynthia Oxney, former federal prosecutor in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Good Friday evening to all of you. Jonathan Lemire, how critical are these next few days for Joe Biden's first term?
Extraordinarily critical. And we've had the president himself become far more personally involved with the negotiations on Capitol Hill, trying to bridge the divide between members of his own party, Democrats, moderates, and progressives alike, who right now can't quite get on the same page when it comes to his two-part legislative agenda, really the heart of his presidency, the infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure bill, and then the much larger reconciliation package, which will be Democrats alone. And what's at stake here, Chris, is nothing less than the fate of potentially Democrats in the midterms next year. And if this were to go down to defeat, it would potentially be a crippling blow to Biden's first term. This would be such a self-inflicted wound. And he used the word stalemate today. He's acknowledging that a lot of work has to be done despite deadlines set next week by the House Speaker and others. But it's not just that, of course. As much as there was good news today, the administration release, officials I've talked to about boosters, that moment you just described, The View, underscored just how devastating this virus is and how its reach can be anywhere at any time and how much work still has to be done there as well. This administration, of course, is still dealing with the fallout of the Afghanistan withdrawal. And now we are seeing potentially a government shutdown. And as much as, to be clear, this is some of the fault here lies at the feet of Republicans being obstructionist, being unable to help. It's not clear that the general public at large will see that. And Democrats who run all parts of government right now could face the majority of the blame. So there's a lot going on right now for this president. He knows this is a pivotal moment in his first year in office.
And we know there's this nervousness about 2022, Susan. But there's also the polling that has shown Joe Biden's approval rating falling over the course of the last couple of months. So what does that mean for him and obviously the party as a whole as they try to move forward on some of these big initiatives that Jonathan just talked about?
Yeah, President Biden had an approval rating that was above the 50% mark. That's pretty healthy in today's polarized politics, but it's clearly sunk. It's down now in his approval rating down in the mid 40s, and more people in most polls now disapprove rather than approve of the job he's doing as president. That's important to things like the Virginia governor's race, the biggest race we have coming up on this election day. Very competitive, even though Virginia has become a Democratic-leaning state. And we know that one of the most important things in determining what happens in the midterm elections next year will be the approval rating of the sitting president. So Democrats at this moment are pretty alarmed by what they're seeing happening at the White House. That said, positive vote next week, if Nancy Pelosi delivers what she has offered to do or said she would do, which is bring both these big bills up next week, if they get through the House, if she managed to somehow thread the needle between moderates and progressives and get hold Democrats together, that will cure a lot of the ills that the Biden White House has. And that will be a demonstration that Democrats are able to govern, that they are functional, and that they are on the road to delivering the guts of his domestic agenda. If the alternative happens, more bad news for the White House.
Yeah, and so much that's important that the president needs to get done. But Cynthia, still plenty of Republicans, supporters of the president, who 248 days in are fighting the fact that he lost this election pretty significantly. So I want to play for you what the Republican vice chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors said about that so-called audit tonight on CNN.
The cyber ninjas, they came into this with preconceived notions. This should be something that can really start to turn the tide. This could be the beginning of the end of the big lie. But what we need to really accomplish this is now have our elected officials, Republican elected officials, like we've done in Maricopa County, stand up, leaders here in the state, and say, OK, this needs to come to an end. Joe Biden won. It's time to move on.
Time to move on, but I guess, will they? First of all, Cynthia, what's your reaction to the outcome of this? And will there be any end, do you think, to these reviews? Or is that sort of part and parcel of U.S. politics from now on, that audits can go on indefinitely, even in states where the accusing party actually won?
Well, you know, this was a big week for the big lie. First, we had the reviews from the Durham investigation, which was supposed to expose the big lie before the big lie about how Trump was hounded. And that went down in flames and nothing happened with that. And then we have the audit, which it turns out has done nothing except prove that Biden won the election. And that has led us into the governor of Texas saying he's going to have audits. And even though it appears to rational people that this is all underlying the truth, that Biden won the election, the result is still very dangerous, because the result is that 40% of the people, or a majority of the Republican Party, these people think Trump won the election. And so on some level, the big lie has won, even though factually it's unsupported. And, you know, all these courts have ruled on it and we have all this evidence. That's what concerns me, is that it doesn't matter on some level to these voters that, you know, up is down and down is up. And they have decided that they're going to support Trump, true or false. And I'm afraid the big lie has succeeded. And I don't see a way. I don't see a way that it's going to be defeated until 2024 if Trump runs and loses again.
So, Jonathan, of course, the big lie led to the insurrection, and now the White House, the Biden White House, sounds as if it's willing to help the January 6th committee. What's at stake here? How important could this be to that investigation, and, you know, all of it playing out under the politics of 2022 isn't so far away?
Well, let's flash back first to note that how many times during the Trump administration where there were congressional investigations into alleged misconduct by the president's associates, and the president would exert executive privilege, or, you know, the strategy from the White House aides and Republican Party at rich large was just simply just say no. And they wouldn't cooperate with the Democrats who controlled the House of Representatives at the time. They would just thumb their nose at the attempts to investigate. That's different now, of course. Democrats are in power. Trump's no longer in office and no longer can utilize executive privilege himself. And what happened today is that we heard from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki that the White House was not inclined, this administration, not inclined to go along with that, to help out Trump and his allies with executive privilege that would indeed cooperate with documents being turned over to the January 6th Select Committee. Not the bipartisan commission, of course, because the Republicans in the Senate put the kibosh on that. But this still an aggressive and thorough investigation into what happened that day. One is that is ramping up rapidly and calling in subpoenaing some of the former president's closest allies, Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows among them. So it will be difficult for those allies of former president to stay away from Capitol Hill and a room where they will be forced to testify as to what happened. The political fallout remains to be seen, but certainly this shows this is a very different time than when Trump was in power and did his best to sweep under the rug the alleged misdeeds of his closest allies.
Yeah, very different DOJ. But Cynthia, give me your assessment of how this panel, the January 6th panel, is proceeding. We've already seen those four subpoenas, but they've made it clear that more are coming. How aggressive do you think it's going to get? Look into your crystal ball. What do you see coming?
Well, they're going to have to be very aggressive because they have a couple of options. They have civil remedies, which I think we've learned in the last 5 years go nowhere with this crowd because they don't comply with subpoenas and all they do is stall. And their whole goal is to stall past the midterms and then have subpoenas withdrawn and not have to do anything. So the civil, to me, they need to go forward with civil, but that's going to go nowhere. And that's going to leave them with criminal contempt. I mean, that's where this is going to have to go. And if we don't do criminal, and the way that criminal contempt works is if the documents are not produced in October as required, or they don't show up, then the House will have to vote, hold them in criminal contempt, and it'll have to go to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice will have to prosecute it. And if they don't comply, they're going to have to be arrested. I mean, that's the only way we're going to get this information. Here's the thing. Steve Bannon is not showing up for this deposition. He doesn't care that executive privilege doesn't apply. So they will stall civilly. They'll claim executive privilege. They'll claim some other type of privilege. And they're not playing by the same set of rules. And the only way to get their attention is going to be to go ahead and use criminal contempt. Otherwise, this will just go the same way as every other investigation has gone in the Congress.
Yeah, just so many things going on, Susan, while, I mean, frankly, Nancy Pelosi has to get the sausage made. You know, she's got to figure out how she's going to wrangle this time, even though she's known as a master wrangler. Look, you wrote a book about her. What's your take on how she'll approach all this drama on Capitol Hill and how and if, more importantly, she'll be able to pull off next week in terms of votes?
You know, it's interesting. Democrats are pretty downbeat, but there are two things that have struck me that make Democrats optimistic that this will work out. One is Pelosi's record in muscling big things through, especially the Affordable Care Act. So over and over again, you'll hear members of Congress. I heard one on the show just before this one on MSNBC with Eric Swalwell saying that he had trust in Nancy Pelosi to somehow make a deal where there seems to not be one. The other thing that makes Democrats optimistic is that the consequences of failure are going to be so serious. The consequences of not taking this moment, the best moment probably they'll have during the Biden presidency to actually get something done, a big agenda item done. They let this fall, that it would be a demonstration that they are not a party that is ready to govern. And so even though Democrats don't quite see how progressives and moderates can come together when they've drawn lines in the sand that are so opposite one another, those are the two things that make them think maybe they'll succeed.
Susan Page, Jonathan Lemire, Cynthia Oxney, thank you all very much. And coming up, the big lie goes bust again, but that won't stop the MAGA faithful who are still saying our last election was a fraud. And later, Congress versus the Biden agenda. With lawmakers as divided as the rest of the nation, can anything get done? The 11th hour, just getting underway on a Friday night.
My hope is that we can put these results of the last election behind us and that we can look forward. Many of my Republican colleagues, conservative colleagues, that just don't trust the system. They don't trust the media. They don't trust the election process. And that is a fundamental threat to our future existence. And we have to overcome it. And fanning these flames of this lack of faith in our institutions is problematic.
Despite that urgent call from one Republican congressman to just move on, and the fact that Arizona's expensive election audit has only shown Joe Biden won by an even wider margin than we thought, it has inspired copycat efforts in more states. Columnist Greg Sargent writes this in The Washington Post, quote, "It's already clear that some Republicans will not use the audit news to affirm that confidence in our election system has been restored. Instead, they'll use it to continue undermining that confidence for the express purpose of justifying further anti-democratic tactics." Back with us tonight, Don Colloway, who is the Democratic strategist and founder of the National Voter Protection Action Fund, and Bill Kristol, author, writer, thinker, and Politico. He's a veteran of the Reagan and Bush administrations and editor-at-large at The Bulwark. Good to see you guys. So, Bill, I want to play an ad that your group, the Republican Accountability Project, released just today, and it has two Republican, I emphasize Republican, officials from Arizona.
I'm Bill Gates, and I'm vice chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors.
My name is Stephen Richer. I'm the Maricopa County Recorder.
If you aren't willing to speak up now as a Republican, when are you going to? You can't worry about your electoral prospects because we may not have a democracy by the time that you have a re-election.
If lying about the election system, lying about the very form of government with which you were elected, if January 6th isn't your line in the sand, what is?
Look, Bill, we've talked a lot about this, but is it, do you agree? Is it so bad now that you worry literally about the future of our democracy? Is that where we are?
Yeah, I think it would be foolish not to after what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years. It's not just Donald Trump. It's that the Republican Party at every moment has capitulated to him, enabled him, and continues to do so amazingly, even though he's no longer president. And now this all has a momentum of its own. So in state after state, the two officials we saw, the honorable officials in Arizona who stood up to the mob, are extremely unpopular with their own party. It's very unclear what their future is. The governor, Doug Ducey, who's a reasonable person, he did call the state. You know, he refused to intrude in the state's election count and help Trump steal the election in Arizona. Nonetheless, he hasn't spoken up against this fake audit. Now these audits are going elsewhere, and whatever they find, they're laying the predicate for, well, we have one election, we have the very careful count, we have a recount, and then we have a kind of crazy audit because they've legitimated the notion that you can get a political group in to overcome or try to overcome the actual election return. So I know, I think it's bad.
Yeah, Don Colloway, among those states, Texas, I can't say this enough, we can't reiterate this enough, a state Donald Trump won, is now going to do an audit in four major counties. In the first 7 months of this year, you know this, 18 states also enacted 30 laws restricting access to the vote. Where does this end?
It ends in Donald Trump coming back and running, quote unquote, successfully in 2024. But prior to that, it ends in sowing seeds of doubt for these midterms we have coming up, the congressional and Senate elections again in 24. And if, again, people begin, as Bill said, people's faith in the democratic process erodes because of what their Fuhrer Donald Trump is telling them and because of what his acolytes are telling them, if their faith erodes, then as populations brown, as more younger LGBTQIA, black and brown people, immigrants, become eligible to vote as they actuarially take over numbers in the population, then you can continue to sow those seeds of doubt to combat that growing electorate, which is more than likely not to vote Republican. And so you've planted these seeds of doubt. They continue to grow and fester and germinate throughout popular opinion. And then you have faith in elections essentially non-existent as a new electorate comes to play. So this is a long-term messaging play on behalf of, I won't even say the Republican Party, I'll just say some really anti-democratic forces, and it's dangerous for the foreseeable future.
Which brings us to the key question of what we do about it. And Bill, our friend Matthew Dowd had some thoughts on what we need to prioritize to safeguard our democracy. Take a listen.
I think today our democracy is broken. 2022 is by far way more important than 2020, because what happens if the Republicans win in 2022? It means that everything they've done, January 6th, all the things that have happened, all the way they've conducted themselves in the aftermath of the 2020 election, they're going to be let loose with no reins. Honestly, vote Democratic from the top to the bottom to try to force the Republicans to change what they're doing.
Bill, what does let loose with no reins look like, and can it be stopped?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think it would be safer, frankly, if the Democrats controlled Congress for another 2 years, because it would prevent the Republicans from controlling Congress as we go into the November 2024, one House of Congress even, as we go into the November 2024 election, possibly with Trump there. And then we have one House that might go along with his attempt to overturn the results. And of course, who knows what will happen at the state level. They're trying to purge the decent Republican election commissioners and others who stood in the way of Trump. And it's very interesting. Mitch McConnell, remember that speech he gave after January 6th? He was very upset. He didn't quite vote to impeach, but oh, he's not on Trump's team. He's going along with all of the Trumpist candidates now who are running for the Republican nomination in the big Senate seats in Ohio and Pennsylvania and North Carolina and elsewhere. He has no problem with them, as he's quoted as saying, well, all I care about is if they're Republicans. If all I care about is if we get to 51. He doesn't care about democracy. He cares about the Republican Party controlling the Senate, and it's going to be a Trumpier Republican Party in 2023 than it is now or than it was 2 years ago.
Bill Kristol and Don Calloway have agreed to stay with us. Coming up, what's next for the president's agenda as he speaks out about the importance of breaking that stalemate on Capitol Hill when the 11th hour continues.
It's going to take some time here. We're at this stalemate at the moment, and we're going to have to get these two pieces of legislation passed. Both need to be passed, and they'll have a profound impact, according to not just Joe Biden, but according to Wall Street, according to the IMF, according to international organizations.
The president acknowledging the difficult path ahead to pass his sweeping economic agenda, and that, combined with a messy Afghanistan exit, the border crisis, and ongoing pandemic, all that has some Republicans already writing off what they call a failed presidency. Well, The New Yorker's Susan Glasser writes, it's too soon to consign the president to the ash heap of history, but adds it's not too early for Democrats to start panicking. She goes on to point out, quote, Congress is as deeply divided as the country and arguably even more dysfunctional. There have been four government shutdowns in the past 8 years, and that was before Democrats came to power in Congress with the slimmest majorities in years. Still with us, Don Calloway, Bill Kristol. Don, I want to read some more from Susan Glasser's column. She writes, quote, the difficult truth is that should Congress fail to pass Biden's bills this fall, it would, in fact, be the kind of political blow that few new presidents can recover from. Do you agree?
Joe Biden has had some serious challenges over the last 30 days, and that's that goes without saying. All the way up until this week, when is what we saw perhaps was the administration's newest low with the treatment of the Haitian refugees, which it hurt all of us on the progressive side really badly. If he cannot recover, it is not because he has been particularly a bad president. If he has problems recovering in time for 2024, it will be because of the cadence of the congressional schedule. It is critical that in the fourth quarter of this year, he passes the infrastructure bill, because next year, going into a midterm, people might not know this, but Congress essentially shuts down. It will largely be a do-nothing year so that members have time to campaign. And so those at the middle in the bulk of the competitive congressional seats will have time to really, will be protected from making controversial votes. So next year, Congress essentially shuts down. And then moving into 23 and his own reelection in 2024, there won't be a whole lot of activity if Joe Biden does not control both halves of Congress. So the next 3 months are critical. He's got to pass an infrastructure bill. But I think that he has done enough, child tax credit, ending the war in Afghanistan. He's done enough to campaign on. But these 3 months are critical. He's got to produce, because next year is going to be a shutdown year.
You know, Bill, I think you could definitely argue it's a little early for all this angst and hand-wringing by some Democrats. But what is undeniable, Biden needs this victory on these two bills, and Democrats believe that they need this victory, too. Do you agree with that? What do you think Biden's likely to come away with?
Democrats are awfully, they're really good at hand-wringing, I've got to say, now that I'm friendlier to more Democrats than I used to be. And I don't say this, you know, I really don't say this condescendingly. They care about these issues. They really think these programs are important. You can't do everything at once. Look, if he gets COVID, if we turn the corner on COVID, which I think we may be pretty close to, we get the boosters here in Virginia, we're beginning to get them tomorrow for people 65 and over and for healthcare workers and others of all ages. And then we get with this new CDC recommendation. We're going to get, I very much hope, the vaccine for kids, which will be a huge relief for parents. I think they could do a much better job on rapid testing. But if he can get COVID, if we can turn the corner on COVID and have a sound economic recovery, and I think both of those are very doable by a couple of months from now. I think he then needs a couple of other things. The bipartisan infrastructure bill will be important. He can get elements of the big reconciliation bill next year if he has to. A lot of it doesn't go into effect for 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. People don't even know what's in it, honestly, a lot of the people who are talking about it. So I'm less panicked about the infrastructure bills. I do think there's a general question of just, you know, seeming strong and competent. Presidents go up and down. But I actually, I had this hunch tonight that maybe I'm wrong, that this might be this last week, all the panic. It feels like a contrarian indicator. You know, what do they say, Chris, in the stock market? You know, when everyone's bearish, you should be a bull, yeah. You should buy. I feel like we might have sort of a contrarian indicator with everyone writing these articles, not Susan, because she says, you know, don't write a count them out. And Don says the same thing. But, you know, everyone's saying, oh, my God, terrible situation. I think they could have a pretty good recovery here and get at least, I think they'll get at least the bipartisan bill through. And I think things could look pretty different two or three months from now.
Although you're right, Don, there's a lot of disappointment, particularly in the progressive wing in the party. But I think throughout the Democratic Party about what they saw at the border. Another Democratic priority failed this week. Efforts for the bipartisan bill on police reform fell apart on Capitol Hill. This is what Eugene Robinson wrote in the Washington Post, quote, "The Democratic Party has shown it is willing to negotiate and win support from skeptics such as the police unions. But across the table is a Republican Party that is fine with letting a doctor or a nurse be sued by any random individual for performing a constitutionally protected abortion, but will not let a police officer be sued for committing an unlawful and fatal assault." What's your reaction to these talks falling apart?
You know, Eugene Robinson is right. DeRay McKesson and Campaign Zero have done a lot of work on substantive police reform. And what they found, and I've kind of been aside by them with a lot of this work, what we found is that on a large, broad-based level, particularly in the states, and we see that manifested here in Washington, D.C., Republicans agree that we don't want a Derek Chauvin. They want to make it illegal to put a knee on necks. But they don't want broad-based substantive police reform. They might want criminal justice reform. I think they're okay with reducing some of the sentencing and legalizing marijuana even in some places. But they really don't want broad-based police reform because they don't want to touch qualified immunity, like Eugene Robinson alludes to. They don't want to touch looking at the actual police union protection and the police union contracts that really insulate police officers from a lot of really, really atrocious behavior. And I think that we saw that this week in Washington, D.C. with Tim Scott having to pull out of negotiations because they don't want real reform. They don't want Derek Chauvin choking a man to death and essentially lynching him on videotape. But I think we've seen the Republican infrastructure be really exposed here for being disingenuous. They don't want serious police reform.
Don Callaway and Bill Kristol, thank you for staying up with us on this Friday night. And coming up, what we heard from the CDC director today about her decision to go against an advisory panel on those Pfizer booster shots. Dr. Kavita Patel will explain just how rare this move is and what it all means when the 11th hour continues.
I want to be very clear that I did not overrule an advisory committee. I listened to the votes. I listened to the comments on the votes. And this was a scientific close call. In that situation, it was my call to make.
The CDC director today defending her decision to clear frontline workers for Pfizer boosters, even though her advisory panel didn't. The New York Times reports today, quote, Dr. Walensky's decision to go against her own agency's advisors came as a surprise to at least some of her staff members. The CDC director's endorsement of the advisory committee's recommendations is typically just a formality. Hours before her statement, agency insiders predicted she would stick with the usual protocol because doing otherwise would undermine the process and upset the advisors as well as her own staff. Back with us again tonight, Dr. Kavita Patel, clinical physician and former senior policy aide during the Obama administration. She's also one of our public health experts and a non-resident fellow at Brookings. Great to see you. What's your reaction to this move by the CDC director, and were you surprised?
So good evening, Chris. Yes, I was surprised for all the reasons you mentioned. This has only historically happened once, and it wasn't exactly similar, but this is not common. But I will tell you this, it was the right outcome with a very circuitous process. So I do think that she did make the right call ultimately. And there has been mounting evidence to support the part of the decision that she did technically kind of go against the CDC's advisory vote. And that had to do with high risk occupations. I realize I'm biased. I'm in one of those occupations. But setting that aside, I do think that she did the right thing. And I will say this, Chris, kind of, from your last segment, I think as we move forward and start to see more Americans getting booster shots, and hopefully as case rates are coming down, we will kind of put this in perspective and realize that this was the right decision.
Do you worry, though, that it adds to the confusion that's already out there about boosters in particular, people going to bed at night thinking, teachers, for example, healthcare workers, I'm not eligible? That changes. What do people who now qualify for those Pfizer boosters need to know tonight, and people who don't qualify as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, no question that this did not help to clarify communication about pretty much anything. I would say the most clarity came from President Biden's words today, where he's like, vaccines, vaccines, vaccines. We need to make sure we concentrate on getting people vaccinated initially, and then boosters when you're eligible. So very briefly, you are eligible, as everybody started today, my own clinic, 65 and above, as well as under 65 if you have certain high-risk conditions, or like diabetes, or if you're a smoker, or obesity, and then or that third category of high-risk occupations. There is going to be a little more detail about that because it's hard for an individual to assess, am I in a high-risk occupation, aside from many of the obvious. But to your point, who's left behind? All of us who receive Moderna, Johnson & Johnson. And here's what I would say. If you're in a high-risk setting, if you're in a nursing home and you receive Moderna, I actually think that that's a reason to potentially move forward and talk about having a Pfizer booster. And I'm just being candid about that. But for most people, 97% of the country who received Moderna, I would tell you, Chris, we are going to see some action on their application for their booster shot, reduced dose, hopefully in the next several weeks. And then Johnson & Johnson, similarly. So I would tell all of those people who feel like something's being held back because they're not eligible, simply not the case. You do have durable immunity. It's just going to take several weeks for us to get boosters.
You know, Kavita, we played this clip earlier. The two co-hosts on The View, like getting ready to start the show, found out they tested positive for COVID and had to get off set. And both of them were vaccinated. A lot of people watch that and they think, well, maybe I don't fit into one of these categories, but I'm going to go and try to get it. In fact, Peter Alexander actually asked this question to the president today, who basically said, don't cheat. But, you know, how much wiggle room is there? And does it put folks like you, doctors, does it put people, you know, at the local pharmacy, at the CVS, at the Walgreens in an uncomfortable position? I personally know of people who have been turned away, gone to another pharmacy and then got the okay.
Yeah, I do too, by the way. And I had a patient who is technically high risk and meets qualifications to get a booster today, who begged me to let her daughter, who's in her 30s and very healthy, but visits and kind of doesn't live with her, but visits her frequently. And honestly, it broke my heart to say, no, she really doesn't need it and doesn't meet these criteria. So Chris, you are hitting right on the nerve, I think, that a lot of Americans are feeling, because they see the two views of the two co-hosts of The View, and they're thinking that could be me. I think almost all of us know somebody who's gotten a breakthrough infection and maybe multiple people, some of whom are hospitalized. I'll say briefly, though, breakthrough infections, we're seeing them. They're more common. It's why we're recommending boosters, but we're recommending them in the priority order, for which we know that a breakthrough infection is likely to lead to a hospitalization and hopefully never to happen, but could lead to death. Working backwards, I would say that for the majority of Americans, though, a breakthrough infection is not something we want, but it is something that we will start to become familiar with because, Chris, our future is that we are going to have people who are vaccinated will get infected, but it will not lead to hopefully any of those devastating outcomes because we'll build out enough immunity where those breakthroughs are rare and don't have as much consequence. So I know that people are watching every day and hearing more and more and worried about their own immunity and not getting enough. That's simply not true unless you are in those priority populations. I will hopefully fast forward us to a conversation in 2 to 3 months. I think all Americans are going to have boosters. It's just a matter of time. And that's actually what the advisory committee said. They said, we need more data. They didn't say that people under a certain age should never get a booster. They just simply said we need more data because more of the younger people really only received their vaccines in the last several months. So we're trying to understand that better. I think it's just hard to communicate all of this, as you can tell. But, you know, those first shots, just go to bed tonight knowing those first shots are protecting you. I know this is personal for all of us, for you, for me. And I think a lot of us are living kind of this post-trauma. We don't want to go back there. So, you know, I get that. Yeah. Go forward. Boosters for the high risk. If you are in a category that's high risk and you had Moderna or J&J, have that conversation with your physician. We're ready to talk about that. And like I said, some people really, I would encourage them to get vaccinated.
Dr. Kavita Patel, always great to have you on the program. Thank you so much. And thank you for everything that you do. Coming up, amid the chaos during the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, a story of freedom and hope told in moving images when the 11th hour continues. The Taliban's quick takeover of Afghanistan produced many distressing images. The airport in Kabul mobbed, people desperate to get on evacuation flights. But there are other stories from that evacuation, too, filled with warmth and kindness, thanks to the U.S. service members on the ground. NBC News Pentagon correspondent Courtney Kuby has their story.
Among the chaotic scenes during the rushed withdrawal from Afghanistan, enduring images of the war's most vulnerable, the children, a baby handed over the airport wall to the arms of strangers, U.S. troops cradling newborns, and perhaps one of the most tender images, this little girl, exhausted, asleep on the cold metal floor of a C-17, snuggled in the jacket of Airman Nicholas Barron. Captain Mark Lawson snapped the photo.
After we had initially taken off, there was a general sense of calmness that kind of swept through and relief throughout the personnel that were inside that cargo hold. You saw the small children, they started to lay down and relax and even fall asleep.
A child finally finding peace after escaping this in Kabul. With the tarmac overrun, a split-second decision by the crew to take as many as they could.
We saw an opportunity to save lives, and we took it.
Packing a plane that normally carries 350 with more than 800, the most ever.
Every life matters, right? So we couldn't sit there and say, how do we determine where's the cutoff line? We have to figure out how much we can fit.
As a dad, did you look at these people? Did that factor into your decision to allow so many people to get on this aircraft?
Yes, without a doubt.
A mission that brought pride to the crew.
To give all the all those people another chance at life and provide them with freedom and hope.
A simple gesture of comfort wrapped in the hope of a new life. Courtney Kuby, NBC News, The Pentagon.
Freedom and hope. We're back with more of the 11th hour after a quick break. That is our broadcast for this Friday night with our thanks for being with us. We hope you have a great weekend. Brian, we'll be back on Monday. On behalf of all my colleagues at the networks of NBC News, good night.